Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you here tonight. My name is Andrew Neil. I'm chairman of The Spectator, and it's a pleasure to see you all with us this evening. I apologize for the voice. I've been fighting against it for the past 24 hours. It's not been helped by a live four-hour broadcast today on BBC Two on the Autumn Statement, or with having to deal with David Gok and Rebecca Long-Bailey, which is a way to get you to speak more loudly than you really should in my condition at the moment. Anyway, I'm delighted to see so many of you here this evening. We're going to get the show underway in just a minute. These have become biannual events now with both the budget and the Autumn Statement, though the Chancellor today abolished the Autumn Statement, which rather disappointed us. And then said he was going to have a spring statement. So we went, "Wee, that's so fine. We don't really care what time of year it is." And I understand now that what will happen is that there will be two budgets next year. There'll be a spring budget and an autumn budget. And then in 2018, there'll be a spring statement and then an autumn budget. Is that right, James? Have I got that?
Yeah, so next year there will be two budgets. And then the year after that, there'll be a spring statement and then an autumn budget.
Did you all follow that? Because there could be a test on the way out. Anyway, why he bothers, nobody knows, but there we go. Tonight is made possible by Old Mutual Global Investors. They are our partners in this autumn statement event this evening. Without them, this couldn't happen. I'd like to welcome to the stage, just to say a few words of welcome to you, the Chief Executive of OMGI, Richard Buxton.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is going to be very, very brief. You're not here to listen to me. I am indeed a fund manager at OMGI, as well as, bizarrely, the chief executive. The fastest growing asset management company you've probably never heard of. OMGI stands for Old Mutual Global Investors. We're not old. We're nearly four. We're certainly not mutual. We By a very broad stretch of the definition of global, we just about qualify, but we definitely do some investment. So 1.5 to 2 out of 4, as I constantly tell my clients, isn't a bad result. If you are looking to invest in UK equities, I man a 16-strong team of investors. We have funds that invest purely in small companies, in medium-sized companies, in large companies. We have long-only funds, we have long-short funds, we have absolute return funds, which take out the market volatility and just give you the stock picking alpha we can generate. So if you are thinking of investing in dear old Blighty, then you know, do look us up. My particular fund focuses on large companies, and clearly they are currently in the sweet spot because they're benefiting from the decline in the value of the British peso. Pound. So really, great privilege to be working with Andrew, the Spectator. I hope we'll be able to do it again, irrespective of spring or autumn. But do please enjoy the evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Richard, for that. So I don't call it OMGI, it's OMGI. Sounds actually like a Japanese fund investor. OMGI. And we're delighted to have you as our partners tonight. I'm going to say a few words just to try and paint a broad brush picture, try and put today's autumn statement in context. I'll then ask Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, to do some of the number crunching that he does every time at this time of year. And then James Forsyth, our political editor, to place it all in a political context. And then we'll throw it open to all of you to ask some questions. So let me begin. I want to place this now in what has been the most important event this year, which was not Brexit, important though that was on June the 23rd, but the election of Mr. Trump on November the 8th. And I think because we have been so obsessed with, naturally, our own follow-through from Brexit, we haven't yet worked out what the international implications of Mr. Trump's victory is. And on the economic side, they could be quite profound. Now, they could also be chaotic. That is in the nature of the beast, if I can put it like that. But they could also be very profound. And by profound, I mean that it signals to me, a Trump presidency, the move of the global economy away from worries about deflation to a return to inflation. And that is a huge, significant watershed that is now underway. And it also means, as it follows from that, the end of the ultra-cheap money that we've known on both sides of the Atlantic since the great crash of 2008. Now, for the 6 or 7 years that we have done a spectator budget specials and autumn statement specials, I have stood here in front of audiences like you and said, despite what the markets say, despite what the forward guidance of the Bank of England, despite what the city pundits say, there will be no rate increases in the year ahead. Tonight, I do not say that to you. We are moving into a world now of rising interest rates. Not dramatic, not back to where they were in the 70s or even the 80s, but we are now reaching the turn in the interest rate cycle, and the trajectory will now be up. If not in administered rates by the central banks immediately, certainly in market rates. And you can see that already happening with bond yields going up, both sovereign and corporate bond yields going up all over the place. What Mr. Trump represents with his plan for, and I would just point out to this audience that on November the 8th, the Keynesian won. Mr. Trump is FDR and Ronald Reagan on steroids with a massive unfunded tax-cutting plan and a massive infrastructure spending plan. Now, at one stage, I didn't think that he would get the tax plan through because he would come head-to-head with the fiscal conservatives of the Republican congressional leadership. But I stayed on after the election and discovered that actually the Trump plan had been drawn up, not the one he talked about, but the actual one had been drawn up so that there was an 80% overlap with Speaker Ryan's tax cut plan in the House. And so there is no question that at some stage next year, the House and then the Senate will pass a massive tax cut bill in the United States. It will not be exactly the same as Mr. Trump wanted it. It won't be the same as Speaker Ryan wanted it. But that's essentially a matter for domestic American politics. What does matter is that it is a massive global reflation of the biggest economy in the world. And what this means is that we are switching from loose monetary policy, which we have had since 2008, in Japan, in Europe, in the United Kingdom, and in America now, to a looser fiscal policy. And it follows as night follows day. If you move to a looser fiscal policy, then monetary policy tightens. Now, as I say, you can already see that in global bond yields, but you will soon be able to see that in administered rates by the Federal Reserve. I do not know for sure if Chairwoman Yellen will increase the Fed basic rates in December. It's only just over, it actually will take place in the first week of December. I think she will, but even if she doesn't, she will raise rates next year, not once, not twice, but probably three times. Because if we are moving into a much more reflationary environment, then it is the job of the monetary authorities to start to tighten that money so that it keeps inflation under control. And this is led by the United States. It's ahead in this interest rate cycle, which is why the dollar is now so strong on a trade-weighted index at a 14-year high and likely to stay very strong. But it will have the effect, America will have the effect of pulling up these bond yields all over the world. Because if you are at the moment invested in, say, a 10-year Spanish bond, which is paying around 1% and has some risk with it, why would you not move to buy T-bills in the United States, which are paying over 2% and in the dollar, and obviously a much better bet than Spanish sovereign debt. And so other sovereign debt yields will have to rise as well as America sucks this money in. And as that money is sucked in, of course, the dollar rises because you have to buy dollars to buy American T-bills. So this is quite a major change that is taking place. And it brings with it risks. It brings with it risks in the emerging markets, who have a huge dollar exposure and will have to refund their debt. $3.3 trillion of emerging market debt is denominated in dollars. That will be more expensive to do at a time when their currencies don't buy many dollars and when interest rates are rising. And it brings nearer to home particular difficulties for the peripheral economies of the Eurozone. And already we've seen Italian 10-year bonds double in yield since August of this year. And Spanish and Portuguese and, of course, the Greeks have also risen too. Italy is a particular danger of being a perfect storm because not only does it have massive debt that is now more expensive to service, it has a constitutional referendum on December the 4th, which Mr. Renzi, the Prime Minister, looks like losing, in which case you could see both a political constitutional crisis come together with a new economic crisis, and that's what I mean by a perfect storm. So there are risks. The reason I mention these global developments is to try and put what Mr. Hammond did today into context. Because Mr. Hammond announced a seriously looser fiscal policy for the United Kingdom. He now plans to borrow £122 billion more pounds than the Chancellor planned to borrow in March of this year by 2021. So it's a massive increase. And indeed, it will take Britain's debt, accumulated national debt, to just shy of $2 trillion. I think that figure was concocted to make sure it didn't have a two in front of it to avoid headlines in tomorrow's papers. It's $2 trillion as much as it matters. But he is unlikely to be penalized in the markets because he's not alone. Indeed, everybody's at it. Even before Mr. Trump moves into the White House in the American fiscal year, which ended September the 30th, little notice in this country. The budget deficit rose by 36% compared with 2015. The French budget deficit is rising fast because in a desperate and ultimately failed bid to be re-elected, Mr. Hollande has decided just to unloose the spigots. Italian budget deficits are rising. Spanish and Portuguese budget deficits are rising. And the Commission has said that even though there is no chance that they're now following the Maastricht criteria, they will not be penalized. So a looser fiscal policy is now apparent across the board. Mr. Hammond, in a sense, has just joined the herd. You see it in America, France, Spain, and Portugal. And as a result of that, I don't think anyone is likely to be picked out. Now, why have we gone to this position? Well, part of the problem has been it all hinges on the OBR's forecast that the economy slows to 1.4% next year and 1.7% in 2017. It's interesting that the OBR says it goes back to 2% in 2019 and in 2020. Now, I'll come on to that in a minute. But let's just step back a bit and work out what that means. That means no recession. No recession in the short term, which the Treasury predicted, and no recession in the medium term, which the Treasury predicted. Growth may be falling, but there is no now predicted post-Brexit recession from the OBR. And I think it's as well just to take stock of that. Now, the reason why the OBR says it's going to slow down is because it expects inflation to rise. That will eat into real living standards and consumer spending will fall. It also, because of the uncertainty, expects business investment to take at least a pause. And these two things together reduce aggregate demand and that will result in the slowdown. And I must confess, both of these things could happen. But they may not happen by as much as the OBR thinks. The OBR is more optimistic on inflation than the Bank of England. The Bank of England, of course, is yet to hit an inflation target in 88 months. But the OBR says inflation peaks at 2.5%. That's not much more than the average earnings rise at the moment of 2.3%. And yes, business investment, I think, will at some stage take some kind of pause, but there is still, as we've seen with Google and Nissan and now Facebook and others, there's still a lot of investment going on. It would only take the OBR to be too pessimistic by a couple of tenths of a percent, and these huge increases in borrowing don't happen. And yet the Chancellor has had to base his deficit forecast on what the OBR has told him. But it doesn't necessarily follow, and there are things that the OBR and forecasters cannot take into account. It may well be that things will slow down in 2017, perhaps not by as much as 1.4%. But growth could return with a vengeance in 2018 by much more than 1.7%, because by then the Trumpian reflation will really have kicked in. America is our single biggest export market. It is also our single biggest market for foreign direct investment. The opportunities for Britain will be huge in this reflation, and that could well play, particularly with a competitive pound, into a strong growth in 2018. I was told last night by some people involved in the Pentagon that the United Kingdom is now America's fourth biggest arms contractor. Fourth biggest arms contractor, up there with Boeing, Lockheed, and so on. And Mr. Trump is promising a 350-strong warship Imperial Navy and other investment. There will be huge opportunities for Britain in this. I don't often feel sorry for the OBR, whose record has never really impressed me, but I did feel sorry for them today. I think it's very difficult to predict how the economy is going to go in the next couple of years. And so they basically took a city consensus forecast, made it slightly more optimistic, and that was that. What I would just say is that Mr. Hammond, I think, in a way, has behaved like an incoming chief executive. If you're the incoming chief executive, the first thing you do is to get rid of all the bad news and blame it on the people before. And I think in a sense today, what happened was, let's make it as bad as it seems, implicitly blame it on what went before, on things out of his control. And so when we come to the spring, whether it's a statement or a budget, you may find that he will be saying, thanks to my magical wizardry of this economy, it's not nearly as bad as I was told, and actually I'm not going to borrow nearly as much. And certainly in a global context, I think you could see that is at least a possibility. How could the OBR factor in the consequences of a Trump reflation? How could they factor in the consequences of a Brexit, although they have put a figure on it, we don't know what the shape of the Brexit will be. So it's a lot more uncertain than the OBR has made out. And it certainly doesn't mean we will necessarily be borrowing as much as they say. So that's trying to place what happened today in something more of an international context. Let me ask Fraser now to take to the lectern over there and to go through the numbers in some detail to let you see what the Chancellor did today. Fraser.
Thank you, Andrew. Right, now, this is Autumn's statement. What it is not is the punishment budget that we were promised before the referendum. And that's an important point to start in, because right now, anybody who survived the election through the referendum campaign will have been told all sorts of things from all sorts of economists about what a Brexit vote would mean and what it wouldn't mean. Very difficult to tell, given that everybody was estimating who had it right and who had it wrong. It remains very difficult to tell. But let's start from a scenario you painted. The last time we heard from the Treasury, other than today, was when they did the wee dossier. Now, in those... okay, this isn't quite going as according to plan here. I'm sure these clever guys up in IT, is he awake? Anyway.
Hello? This, of course, never happens.
Right. Anyway, look, I've got some fantastic slides for you guys tonight. I can tell you how much fun I've had putting these together.
Here's the Chancellor's coming to sort it out.
Anyway, look. We are. Now, the former Chancellor, who's now...
I really wouldn't go away.
I'll just tell you guys, isn't that okay? Look, anyway. Right. We've heard a lot about what an immediate vote of a Brexit vote would mean. A lot of people were saying then that it would... Oh, it's almost arrived? Let's go back to our Chancellor. Here he is. Now, Mr. Osborne. We might remember some of these things. A vote to leave would push our economy into a recession, an immediate one. Q3 growth right now was supposed to be negative in Q4 as well. Suffice to say, that hasn't happened. Instead, as James points out in the cover piece stem tomorrow, the British economy has grown faster than the Eurozone after Brexit. The falling pound has helped people come here and shop with all sorts of benefits which people didn't expect. Lead to an increase in unemployment of about 500,000. Now, that was a lot. That's a significant thing. If we voted for Brexit, not when Brexit took place, if we voted for it, and house prices would also be hit. The Treasury spoke about a 13 to 18% drop for house prices. And anybody here who hasn't got a house will have been praying that was true. Half of my office was voting for Brexit only to get Osborne's house price crash. And they were so annoyed they voted for Brexit and it didn't happen. But let's go through some of these claims, leaving old Pinocchio, who I'm going to miss so much, for a minute. Right, so the recession, not quite. The best growth in the G7 this year. This is quite extraordinary, in spite of Brexit. I mean, there are something like 15 economists who are predicting a recession after the Brexit vote. They've all had to tear up this forecast and admit that Britain has done it again. Now, bear this in mind when you're thinking of next year's growth. I mean, we had thought in the autumn statement last year. Growth pretty decent, pretty steady. By the time George Osborne gave his last budget, it was still pretty steady and decent. Now we're looking at a different picture. We're looking at growth this year of better than expected, a dip next year, a dip the year after. But look at this. By 2019 and 2020, growth is back to where it was going to be originally. So the OBR thinks this Brexit effect is only actually going to hit these 2 years. And even then, it's significant, but not by that much. Now, had the OBR released this forecast before the Brexit, you can see why George Osborne now didn't want them to do anything during the campaign. This would have conflicted with what he was saying. The Treasury pretty much says what the Chancellor tells them to. And the OBR is more neutral. And they thought there would be a mild effect. But if you're thinking about a decision that's going to last Britain for the rest of everybody's lifetimes, 2 years of relative pain, it's not the end of the world. Now, and even when we're talking about pain next year, we're going to have moderate growth. This is the first year of Brexit hitting, yet still growth roughly the same as France and that of Germany. So again, let's put the pain into some perspective. The downgrade we've had was pretty tough. We've been downgraded more than any other country in the developed world this year. The IMF downgraded us by more than the OBR did. But still, it's not that bad. Now, let's think about this 500,000 jobs. These show you, every time we've sat through and given you these forecasts, we've told you how the OBR thought employment was going to go. From when Tories took over, it was there, about 29 million. They expected it to go along like this, first of all. And every single time, the actual performance of the economy has blown the forecast out of the water. The OBR has got it wrong. Everybody's got it wrong. This is why people talk about the jobs miracle, because what's going on here defies the economic model. Now, I won't bore you with why I think this happened, but let's think. Over here, we were told there could be 500,000 job losses. Well, what actually happened? So there are 500,000 more jobs are expected between now and the end of this parliament. So the exact opposite to what the Treasury said pre-Brexit. Now, of course, as any economist will tell you, there's a trade-off. Lots of people are in work, but the salary growth is accordingly going to be subdued. This is the bad news. There's no two ways about it. We've had this incredible jobs growth because people have overestimated how much salaries are going to be increased. A lot of people have not had a pay rise for a long, long time. So that's the flip side of this chart. And you can tell here, look at this. This is average employee earnings. Look at that kind of limbo. It's and we're going to make this recovery. So by 2020, pretty much back where you were in 2008. Oh, not! I don't have a button for that here, but it sounds a great idea. But, I mean, just by the way, never in the recorded history of our country have earnings taken such a long and deep bath. This is a bad news story, and it's one that's got slightly worse under today's projections, because look at that, another 2 years has been added on to the earnings recovery. So that is significant. So the employment numbers are one story, the wages are another part of that story. And people who are basically still paid less than they were a few years ago don't really feel the word recovery really applies to them, understandably so. This is happening in America as well. And a lot of the, I think, the anger behind the Brexit vote and the Trump vote can be partly explained in this strange kind of defect we've seen in the economy. Now, those at the very bottom are going to get a wage rise. You're going to get the national living wage is going to go up to £9. Now, this is something I came across, which I thought was quite interesting. Up until now, the normal living wage has covered about 3% of the workforce. Not very much. But now, whew, look at that. The government is going to basically nationalise the salaries for something like 12% of the workforce. That's quite significant. That means Britain's minimum wage will cover more, a greater share of the workforce than pretty much anybody else's free economy in the free world. Now, the flip side to the price we pay for lower growth is higher deficits. So the last time George Osborne gave a budget, he was hoping to get the deficit down negative. Basically, he would be taking in more money than he spent by 1920 and the rest of it. Now, look how much that picture has now changed. We've got significantly higher, and look at this, especially here, £35 billion more debt. In total, £122 billion. This is absolutely massive. Absolutely massive. And it's not all to do with Brexit. Brexit counts for about, the OBR reckon Brexit effect is about half of that, about £50 billion of that. I mean, the Chancellor has today gone on an infrastructure splurge, saying, yeah, I don't have the money, but I'm going to borrow it anyway and I'm going to invest because that's what you should do. Now, that was the argument that Labour used to make. Now, the Tories would never do that while they were still afraid of the Labour Party. But now, nobody's afraid of the Labour Party, apart from the Labour Party. So the Chancellor can pretty much do what he wants, including steal Labour ideas, bad ones and good ones. In fact, so far, only bad ones, actually. But now, this is the OBR also. When you pick up papers tomorrow, you're going to find that the anti-Brexit papers are going to be jumping on this, the price of Brexit. This is how much of the deficit it worsening was contributed by Brexit in the red. So you'll see basically about half of it. That is growth slowing. So there you go. You can now, of course, Scotland has a deficit as well, which is important for those of you who are wondering if Brexit means an independence referendum is more likely. Now, these are the deficits being suffered in the developed world. You know, ours is bad, by the way. Look at that. Worse than Albania, worse than Italy. But not nearly as bad as Scotland. Look at that. Now, no independent country can make its debut as an independent nation with a deficit that size. You need 3% to get into the EU. And with that, I'm not even sure you'd get financing. So for as long as the oil price, which is still pretty low, has actually hurt Scotland's finances like that, you are not... By the way, in the independence referendum, the oil price had this looking about here. So the oil price collapse, still terrible, has really... When you see the polls showing not many Scots want to vote for independence, this is partly why. It is impossible. By the way, these are the Scottish government's own figures. This is an SNP document producing this. So bear that in mind next time you hear that Brexit is going to push us Scots into some kind of Afghanistan fiscal hellhole. Not going to happen. Now, the pound, anybody who's been on holiday will know, has taken a bit of a battering, 13% down on a trade-weighted basis. This actually helps trade this year and next year. It's going to push inflation up a wee bit. But I want to put this into perspective. This 13% is, you know, bad, but 1976, just as bad. Black Wednesday, a little bit worse. In fact, the 2008 financial crisis, which, you know, was actually a far worse dip in the pound than we've had right now. So what we're seeing is a fairly standard sterling correction, which has, I mean, advantages as well as disadvantages. The Greeks would love it if they had a currency to devalue right now. It would hit the floor, and we'd all go there on holiday. We'd be giving them a ouzo stimulus or something. I mean, the Spanish would love to have a currency to devalue. This is a good thing for countries when they hit the rocks, as Britain has repeatedly found. Every time we've had a devaluation like this, we've come to be very thankful that we can that our exports are for so much cheaper to the rest of the world. And also, you've got to ask, was the pound overvalued anyway? The IMF did this report earlier on this year, and it calculated that the pound was about 13% overvalued, that we were importing too much, that our own factories were suffering. So you could argue this is now back to normal. And by the way, look at that. That's a problem America's got. No wonder it's so worried about China all the time. Because China's goods are very cheap, artificially so, the IMF is to be believed. And look at that, the Germans. By the way, if you now and again wonder, why do Germany put up with all this stuff? Why do they keep bailing out Greece and Italy? This is why. They've got a currency which is way less than it should be, which makes all German stuff a lot cheaper to the rest of the world than it should be. This is the great euro scam, which keeps Germany happy with the euro and accepting all of these bailouts. Anyway, back to business. Inflation. What will sterling do to inflation? Well, this is how things looked back in March, that it would finally go back to the target. As Andrew says, it has been a long, long time before the Bank of England hit this target, either way too high or way too low. This is how it's looking now. So yes, the sterling weakness is going to push inflation back over 2%. It's going to peak here at the end of 2018 at about 2.6%. But is that really, I mean, considering what we've had recently, this is not an inflation crisis. So yes, the pound's crash is going to affect the economy, but it's not going to push inflation to anything like what you might have heard about, at least not as far as the OBR is concerned. They reckon that only about 20% of the currency value, of when exports go up by a lot, only 20% of that is passed on to the consumer, they reckon. So there you go. They're not that worried about out-of-control inflation. Now, Andrew mentioned earlier on the prospect of a rate rise. And anybody who's seen the gilt yields recently will have noticed the government's spending a lot more in borrowing. Things seem to have turned a corner. But the OBR haven't spotted this. They don't seem to think so. It's quite significant. Look at this. You might wonder, if you've got a mortgage, when will the Bank of England ever increase rates? Well, this is what you were expecting. A couple of months ago, this is what the market thinks now. So that is some way away. And by the way, look at all these previous rate increases that were promised over the years. The rate increase has always been about 3 years away, no matter where you are. But you'll see the market eventually giving up hope of it ever happening. So much so that the Chancellor thinks he can take a bit of a gamble, borrowing shed loads of money, because after all, debt is so cheap. It's exactly when people are lulled into this false sense of security that things might turn and get a bit ugly. So we'll see. And also, these are the forecasts for the government borrowing costs. They're actually expected to be even lower than last time. I'd be surprised if that were true, but that's what they're expecting right now. I personally suspect this is the trap that Philip Hammond has fallen into with all of this extra debt. Now, this is a depressing graph, but I thought I'd finish off with it. This is the national debt. Look at that. Now, when the Tories took over, it was £1 trillion. It's going to heading, and this is how it looked, bad enough. George Osborne was almost going to get put a lid in it here. And this is where it's going to be now, almost £2 trillion. Now, this is real debt that's going to be paid off by real taxpayers, all of us. There's nothing artificial or fake about this. Still very significant. And at the end of it, how small is the state going to be? Well, we're basically, Osborne had plans to get it back down to here, which is about, you know, sure, smaller than it was in the early 60s, but still, the Blair had it smaller, and now it's increased a bit. So the net effect of today's pre-budget report is a bigger government, a hell of a lot more debt, and a Chancellor praying
that the debt interest rates will not rise in the way that I suspect they're about to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right, so that's some of the number crunching, and you can ask Fraser lots of questions later. Let's go to our political editor, James Forsyth, now to get this into its political context.
So by tradition, after a budget or an autumn statement or a spring statement, the Chancellor of the Exchequer goes to address Tory backbenchers. And when Philip Hammond turned up today to address them at about 5 o'clock, I saw one of the rarest sights in politics, a Philip Hammond smile. And that was even before it was pointed out to him that Newsnight last night had found an ex-girlfriend of his to describe him as a surprisingly good kisser. So why is Philip Hammond smiling, having delivered what you could say was a lot of bad news? I think it's because this statement has gone down remarkably politically smoothly. You know, you have had a Chancellor of the Exchequer turning up and saying, our previous plan to have the books balanced by the end of this parliament has now been ripped up, and I can't give you a date for when we're going to get the books balanced. I'm just going to say that we hope to do it as early as possible in the next parliament. I mean, that is never, never stuff. And it, I think, is a remarkable statement of the disparity in British politics on fiscal credibility, that a Conservative Chancellor can say this without any concern about what the opposition might do with that statement. He has essentially admitted that there is not going to be a surplus in this parliament, which was one of the Tories' key pledges at the last election and has been kind of one of the defining themes of British politics in the last few years, which is, you know, Tory austerity versus Labour borrowing. And I think one of the other things about today is that Philip Hammond's announcement that he is going to borrow to invest has been met with hardly a murmur of disapproval anywhere in the political spectrum. For 5 years, the Tories hammered Ed Balls on the fact that he wanted to borrow to invest so hard that he's had to go off and dance the rumba. And now Philip Hammond is doing it, and it's all fine. I think there are a couple of reasons why, again, why he's got away with this. First of all, there's obviously Labour's inability, but secondly, there's this. Philip Hammond is the least political Chancellor we have had in a generation. And I think for that reason, when he talks about borrowing to invest, but only to invest in economically productive infrastructure, I think the House of Commons, and remains to be seen whether the market data this view, but I think the House of Commons believes that Philip Hammond will have the discipline to ensure that this money really is spent on economically productive infrastructure, rather than on pet schemes for marginal seats. Philip Hammond has always wanted to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was Foreign Secretary. Most politicians would think that was a dream job. He clearly never enjoyed that job. He's always wanted to be Chancellor of the Exchequer because he has an analysis of what is wrong with the UK economy. He essentially thinks that the productivity problem in the UK stems from a lack of systems infrastructure, essentially. And he thinks that borrowing what is a quarter of a percent of GDP, you can begin to sort that problem out. You can begin to use better technology, better transport, all of which to raise the productive capacity of the British economy, and that is the way to get Britain, in his phrase, kind of match fit for Brexit. Now, Brexit and Philip Hammond have a complicated relationship, shall we say. Philip Hammond was traditionally regarded as one of the more Eurosceptic members of the cabinet, but come the referendum, he was a wholehearted campaigner for Remain. And I think in the aftermath of the referendum, he was one of the people who was, I think, most negative about the prospects of Britain after Brexit. You know, in those immediate weeks and days afterwards, you know, George Osborne went from the architect of Project Fear to a man flying to America to explore the new trading opportunities that Brexit presented. Philip Hammond never shifted from his position that it wasn't economically a good idea. As recently as September, he was telling colleagues that he thought he would have to do a kind of large fiscal stimulus to get the economy up off the floor after the referendum vote. But as today's statement shows, you know, the economy has performed remarkably resiliently since Brexit. And there was a striking change of tone from Philip Hammond on Brexit today in his statement. Rather than his usual woe is us, He instead pointed out that even after the OBR have adjusted the growth forecast down, we are growing, we are forecast to grow faster than France and Italy next year, and at essentially the same rate as Germany. And he said that this would be a source of frustration to many. And I think that was one of the first times I've seen Hammond take a dig at some of our European negotiating partners who have who operated on the assumption that Britain was going to turn up to this negotiation as another Greece, a country that was in such bad economic state. It had no choice but to accept whatever deal, whatever crumbs came off the European Union negotiating table because it was in such a dire state. It is quite clear that the Prime Minister is going to go into those negotiations with a relatively strong and resilient economy at her back. And I think this is just one of five ways in which the UK negotiating position vis-a-vis the rest of the European Union has strengthened since June the 24th. The other is, as Fraser said, Scotland. I think it is now very hard to see how the SNP could win a second independence referendum. At the moment, their argument is that Scotland mustn't be taken out of the EU single market. This is a slightly odd argument, but the response to going leaving the EU single market should be to leave the UK single market, because 64% of Scottish exports go to the UK single market and only 17% to the EU one. So it is pretty obvious which one is more economically important to Scotland. The other is the election of Donald Trump. As Andrew said, that has transformed the global landscape, not only economically, but also geostrategically. I think you can now make the case that Britain is more important to Europe's security than it has been for 60 years. Because for the first time in 60 years, there is a question mark about America's commitment to NATO. And I think you will see Vladimir Putin attempting to probe for weakness, for US recalcitrance to defend Eastern European countries in the coming months. I think it's very telling that he has responded to Donald Trump's election by sending nuclear-capable missiles to Russia's kind of Western enclave in Kaliningrad. He is trying to make the point that he is going to look for weakness. And that means that Europe needs to rely on British security guarantees and the British nuclear umbrella. It is very hard to say to Britain, we intend to punish you for leaving the EU, but at the same time, will you please defend us from the Russian bear? It just doesn't quite add up. And then I think the other thing, which there is the return of the Eurozone crisis. As Andrew said, the spreads on Italian yields are rising already, and that is even before this constitutional referendum on December 4th that Matteo Renzi looks like to lose. Why does a crisis in the Eurozone strengthen Britain's negotiating hand? Because London is the de facto financial and banking capital of the Eurozone. When the single currency is in trouble, to erect barriers between it and its financial and banking capital would be an extremely reckless act. And I think it's very telling if you talk to the people close to the negotiations on the UK side, they say that some Eurozone governments are already acutely aware of this fact, even though the French are oblivious to it. It's often said that in this negotiation, politics will trump economics, and that may well be the case. But the euro is fundamentally a political project, not an economic one. And I really struggle to believe that when push comes to shove, the European Union will be prepared to risk making its flagship political project collateral damage in these Brexit talks. That is why I think ultimately it is highly unlikely that the two-year Article 50 process will come to an end without either an agreement or an agreement to extend the talks further to avoid a cliff-edge scenario, which, while bad for the UK, would be potentially absolutely disastrous for the whole Eurozone project. The thought I will leave you with today is that this autumn statement was really a holding statement. Philip Hammond wants to keep his powder dry. He wants to still have the ability to do something big in terms of fiscal stimulus, which will consist, he has been quite explicit about this in private, that will consist of more infrastructure spending rather than tax cuts if the economy does slow down. If you look at the fiscal rules he invented today, they would allow him to, if the economy slows, to have a stimulus of essentially 1.2% of GDP. To put that in context, that is five times larger than the infrastructure fund that he announced today. So he has some serious ammunition left in the locker to try and deal with the uncertainty that might be coming up. But ultimately, I think that The real big question for the UK economy in the coming years is what happens in the Eurozone, because I think that will dictate the kind of Brexit deal that the UK gets, and also what happens in what remains our single largest exporting market. And I would say that what happens in the Italian referendum on December the 4th is far more important than what was announced in the statement today. Because if Matteo Renzi loses that referendum, as you know, and I know we've all been burned by them recently, but that is what the opinion polls suggest will happen. He has repeated in the last few days that he will resign. He will not lead the next government. That will mean that there'll be early elections in Italy next year. And what is the significance of that? It is the significance of that is that the three largest opposition parties in Italy are now all anti-Euro parties. They all want, at the very least, a referendum on Italian Eurozone membership. And a referendum on Italian Eurozone membership would be an existential threat to the Eurozone. It is worth remembering that when the Opera House plot against Silvio Berlusconi, when Lagarde, Merkel, Sarkozy, the European Central Bank all got together in the Frankfurt Opera House during the interval and agreed that Berlusconi had to go, that was simply because he had taken to musing out loud about how if Italy left the Eurozone, it might not be a disaster, it could devalue. How an Italian referendum on Eurozone membership would make every other Eurozone crisis we have seen to date look like a storm in a teacup. And that would have immensely profound implications for both the European economy and for Brexit.
James Forsyth. Right, thank you. Let's get the microphones out and let's get some questions. Yes, gentlemen there. Keep your hand up so that we can get the mic to you. And there's a gentleman there. Keep your hand up and we'll get it one. Oh, right.
We've seen that debt will increase as a percentage of GDP for a number of years. At what point does this become an existential threat to the economy? Because people are talking about 80% is the limit. It's a bit like a submarine. The lower it goes down, the more the pressure builds on the economy until the submarine cracks. And we're still going down and the pressure's getting bigger. At what point should we worry that the whole thing's going to become unmanageable?
Fraser?
That's quite easy. When the bond market tells us. I mean, right now, it's charging 1.5%, so it suggests it's not very worried at the moment. You've got countries of far worse ratios than that. I mean, like Japan, for example. And then, ultimately, this country can print its own money. Not everybody else can do that. It's a very good question, and we're testing those limits. Right now, the interest rates are low, and we can keep borrowing like this because of the Asian savings glut, basically. There's so much money looking for a home out there. And Philip Hammond would never have thought, no Tory would ever have thought, that you would face this Brexit deterioration and on top of that borrow shed loads of money for an infrastructure splurge. But they think they can get away with it because the market effectively tells them that they can. Now, if the answer to your question does come along, sir, my suspicion is going to take a lot of people by surprise. Remember how quickly it was when interest rates hit the floor. Nobody expected that. Things could reverse, as Andrew was saying earlier, very quickly. The key is that you prepared for this to happen. And right now, Britain does not look like a country which is already prepared.
There was a very influential paper by an economist called Reinhold, who said that 90% was about where it starts to become unsustainable for an advanced economy when national debt hits that. And of course, on Fraser's chart, we hit 90%, even for just 1 year. But part of that is technical. Part of it is to do with the Bank of England's monetary easing policies post-Brexit, which previously that kind of stuff had not counted on national debt. But the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, for very complicated statistical reasons, now decided it should be included. If you strip out that, it's still scary, but it's not near 90%. So, and I think the markets, the bond markets in particular, which are very sophisticated, they will understand that. Italian debt, of course, is 135% of GDP, which is probably a little bit more scary. On the interest rate point, just to clarify, then I take another question. There are two kinds of interest rates. There are interest rates set by the market, and there are interest rates that are administered by the central bank authorities. Now, I think in Europe, the European Central Bank isn't going to move at all until it sees the result of the Italian referendum. Indeed, it meets 4 days later, and it could be under pressure to continue to keep a loose monetary policy. I don't think the Bank of England will be in a rush here to raise rates, but it sure isn't going to cut them again, which was the talk in the summer, that the, indeed, even from the governor himself, he may even take it lower. And maybe at some stage next year, he will add that quarter point back on. But market rates in Europe are already rising. And we can see that from the bond yields, which are rising. Even the German bond yields, the bunds are now rising. In America, I think both are going to happen. The market rates have already risen quite substantially on T-bills. And as I said, I think the Federal Reserve will start to move rates up. And on the mortgage question, it doesn't take the central bank to raise rates for mortgages to go up. If the market rates are rising, that's how mortgages are funded. Mortgages will go up. And this week in America, mortgage rates started to rise.
Question for James, if I may.
Yes.
Is it your understanding of the three Brexiteers that David Davis is the one that's most on top of his brief? And secondly, related to Philip Hammond, is it also true that there is an increasing cohesion between the way those two are working, which potentially may lead to what one might call a smooth Brexit?
Interesting. James?
Well, I think David Davis is the one. Of the three Brexiteers, David Davis has the clearest and most substantive job. Liam Fox is the International Trade Secretary for a country that cannot negotiate its own trade deals at the moment because it's inside the European Union and hasn't even worked out if it wants to leave a customs union that would then allow it to negotiate its trade deals. Theresa May made Boris Johnson Foreign Secretary but then hacked off two massive parts of the Foreign Office from that job, which was obviously the European Union aspect and the trade aspect. I think Davis and Hammond are getting on relatively well. I think there is flexibility being shown on both sides. I think on the customs union question, for example, now, I think the most likely answer to that question is that the UK goes for a Canada-style deal that sees some customs harmonisation made part of the free trade agreement. So I think this is kind of a bit of give and take from both sides within the government. I think the question about whether Brexit is smooth or not ultimately doesn't come down to relations within the UK government. It comes down to what the rest of the EU is prepared to do and how smooth they are inclined to make the process. I personally think how smooth they are inclined to make the process will depend on how much economic pain they are prepared to take. Are they prepared to hurt themselves to try and hurt the UK economically, and also how much they feel that they need the UK on security front. And then this third intangible factor, which is how secure they feel. I mean, one of the ways in which Donald Trump has not helped Britain's negotiation with the EU is that it has made EU governments even more worried about some populist wave coming that they must resist. And I think one of the things about that is that that means lots of the countries that Britain has traditionally formed alliances with within the EU, the more Eurosceptic countries, they are particularly keen to demonstrate that you can't leave the EU and keep all of the benefits. So I think ultimately the smooth Brexit is going to come down to whether the EU27 want to make it happen rather than relations within the UK government.
Let's get some more questions. Yes, gentlemen, there at the back, keep your hand up. And over there. We had dinner with David Davis last week, the three of us, and it was an off-the-record dinner, but I don't think it breaks the confidence to say he was, I think we can agree, he was certainly across his brief. Yes, sir.
It's just really a quick one. What any of the panel thinks about the French election? Okay. It seems to me that what you've said about the 4th of December in Italy might be in sort of small beer compared to what might happen in France.
Well, I think we emphasised Italy first because we were being chronological. If Italy does happen, look, it may not. Italy has a history of bumbling through things. People don't know. The IMF says the Italian economy will not return to its 2007 level until 2027. So it's two wasted decades. Industrial production in Italy is now lower than it was in 1984. But if you go to Italy, as I do, people look pretty prosperous. You know, they're well dressed, certainly better dressed than we are. And they go out at night and they have a good family life and so on. So it could bump, go through, but I think what James and I were trying to say is that the combination of a political crisis at a time when bond yields are spiking is definitely a danger for the French election. I think that's now suddenly got interesting. The defeat of Mr. Sarkozy in the first round of the Republican primary is fantastic news for Marine Le Pen, because he was moving into her territory. Indeed, in some areas, he'd moved to the right over on this, if that's possible to do. But actually, in his case, it is. But he's no longer there. Fillon, who has become the dark horse in this, and will probably win this coming Sunday, the runoff with Juppé, it's going to be an interesting context, because Fillon, of the three Republican candidates, is the most market-oriented, the most anti-dirigiste, most against the 35-hour week, the only one in favour of saying, let's cut the size of the French state, let's reduce some of the, let's slash the labour code in France, which is the biggest labour code in Europe, up against a Madame Le Pen, because the socialists won't make it to the second round in April, in May, a Madame Le Pen who our main view is of a right-wing nativist, anti-immigration, anti-Muslim policies, but her economic policy is Bennite, is protectionist, believes in a big state, protection of French labor, corporatist, big government, big companies working together. Now, the socialist elite will definitely vote for Fillon, but ordinary socialist voters may not when they hear what she has to say. So although the betting is always that the system works in a way that screws the National Front on the second round, and that would still be my guess this time, but I didn't tell you Jeremy Corbyn would be the next leader of the Labour Party, or that Donald Trump was going to be not just president, I didn't even tell you he was going to be the Republican candidate. So if we're wrong about Italy, we'll get a second chance with France. Yes, who's over there?
A question for the panel on our poor productivity, at least according to the statistics. Does the panel think that the Chancellor is right in his diagnosis? And if they do, what do they think of his chances of making a significant impact, which would help the economy enormously? Mm. And if they don't, what do they think is the reason for our poor productivity?
For instance, James was saying that the Chancellor drones on about productivity in cabinet meetings, and when I've met him, he certainly goes on and on. It's always a mystery to me what politicians think they can do about productivity.
I know. Look, I'll give you the answer to what I think. You saw that incredible jobs graph earlier. Now, remember, productivity is economic output divided by the number of workers. The more people are in work, the lower our productivity is going to look. The way I see it, our low productivity is a function of our incredibly high labour market right now. Now, that's a function of relatively low wages. Now, I personally would prefer that we go through a high employment, low productivity recovery than one which is the other way around. So I think our low productivity is a great blessing right now, because we're not scarred by this hideous unemployment that we saw in the early 90s and our previous things. Now, the government, of course, you know, everybody says our productivity is the key to, you know, everything, to earnings growth, and that is true. But if those guys knew how companies should be run better, they wouldn't be in government. I can't quite work out how Spreadsheet Phil here is going to like build lots of bridges and somehow transform the productivity of the economy. So I am not aware of a government that has improved productivity through any means other than regulatory restraint, low taxes, and sound monetary policy. That's the only thing you can do to get out of the way and let companies do it. But I am not that personally worried about low productivity, because I see it as a byproduct of our high employment, which is, I think, one of the single best things about our economy right now.
So, as someone with an economic training, I think most of the productivity figures which we see that politicians use, particularly to run Britain down, is to use a technical term, bollocks. And I'll tell you why. The reason why French productivity is so high is because the official French unemployment figures are 11%, and the real unemployment rate's about 15%. And if you write, I mean, I live in France and I know a lot of French businessmen. I recently held a conference with Michelin, a fantastic French company. I don't mean the restaurant guide, I mean the tires. The first thing you do if you're thinking of investing 100 million euros is to work out how to do it and not employ a single extra person. That's how you do it. And so therefore, young people in France are unemployed. The use of capital makes it highly productive, but there's a huge price and it doesn't really measure anything. Now, in America, the same operates in a different way. And that is that so many people have left the labor force in America that it makes the figures look better. Our participation rate is the highest ever. It's almost 75% of people in our labor force are employed. The American rate, 63%. So the numbers there are a lot. You divide the number working into the GDP, God, they're really productive. You divide our number, it's not so productive because there's a lot more of us there. And I don't think they actually tell the whole picture. All I know is someone who covered British Leyland as an industrial correspondent in the 1970s and looks now at Jaguar, Nissan, Land Rover, Range Rover. Do not tell me that we're not productive where it matters. The change has been unbelievable. Chap with the beard here and chap right at the back.
Andrew helpfully put this all into context at the start in terms of the election of Donald Trump and Brexit. And I just wanted to ask a question about the missing link between those two events, Nigel Farage, and the panel's views on the achievements and future of said individual.
Very well. James.
Look, I think there is... I think Nigel Farage has more chance of being reincarnated as an olive than of being made ambassador to Washington. But I think there is a sensible thing for the British government to do with Nigel Farage, which is no one really knows Donald Trump and the foreign policy people around him. He didn't surround himself with the usual Republican establishment figures. I think that Boris Johnson should invite Nigel Farage down to Cheveningham for a weekend, get some good bottles up from the cellar and find out from him everything he can about Donald Trump, what he thinks and who has influence on him. I think one of the things that lots of foreign governments are thinking about Trump is it seems that the only people he really listens to are his own family. And that creates a real problem for foreign government. How do you get to know Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump? You know, this is not easy. So I think that the sensible thing to do would be to try and use Farage's knowledge. Farage has been shunned by the establishment for so long. But I think if he started being invited to things, was told that he'll get to come to the state banquet when Trump visits the UK and all this stuff, you might find he'd be surprisingly cooperative.
Very interesting. We'll take you now up there. We've got a... Sorry, the light is so strong. But we'll come to you in a minute. I'll take you first and then come up there. Yes, sir.
Yes, this is a question primarily for Fraser. When you said that Philip Hammond had put some stuff in the bank that you think would be more infrastructure spending should he need it. Why, when a Tory Chancellor can get away with borrowing because Labour, the opposition, is so weak, would he not do the Tory traditional of cut the top rate of tax, bring money into the Treasury when the opposition, you know, there is no opposition against him?
It's a very good question, and actually James is far better placed than me to give you the answer to this. I'm not saying that, John, come on. I mean it. James has got a really good answer. He was telling me about it earlier on, which is...
Fraser isn't just the editor. He's the resident Pontius Pilate.
I think it is because... So, in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher looked at a divided left and an unelectable Labour Party and thought, right, this is my opportunity to do things, radical right-wing things, that you could never normally electorally do. Theresa May looks at the current unelectable Labour Party and thinks, right, let's get onto their territory so we're camped out there so that if, the Labour Party returns to sanity, it will find that the Tories are so firmly entrenched on the popular bits of Labour turf that the Labour Party, under its new leader, can't kick them off. I mean, that's the first reason. I think the second reason is that 45p has turned out to be much less of a deterrent than 50p. And in the current climate, they're not prepared to take the risk of cutting the top rate of tax, which would undoubtedly, whatever you think, would undoubtedly be unpopular. I think one of the things that has been justified over recent years is that when George Osborne was very keen to reduce the top rate of tax from 50p to 45p, there were various Tory veterans of the Thatcherites who said, look, I'd rather you left it at 50p and then brought it down to 40p. Because if you take it at 45p, we'll permanently have three rates in the tax system. And it is very difficult to explain that, you know, even with the changes, the 40p rate will kick in at £50,000. Why someone on £250,000 should pay the same tax rate as someone on £50,000. And for that reason, I fear that the 45p rate has become a kind of permanent feature of the British tax system.
I think that's right. And I think also Mrs. May, but I don't think I know, Mrs. May takes the view that if you're in the 45 pence bracket, it means by definition you have assets. And because of QE, assets have done really well. And she touched on this in her Tory conference speech. If you've been in shares, if you've been in property, other assets, the QE money has flooded into that and it's pushed up the price of these assets. You've done all right. 45, if you're a Tory, is too high, but you'll have to wait your turn. It's not my priority. That's the Prime Minister's view. Yes, sir.
Is this live? Yes?
Yep.
I hope so.
First of all, Andrew, I'm privileged to be in the same room as you, and I don't understand how you can work every day at BBC and listen to people that just simply don't answer questions.
You can see it's taking a toll.
I think your patience is infinite, and you must have an incredibly good heart.
You're very kind in the checks and the posts, but what's the question?
You guys down there, I think two questions. I mean, you speak to politicians all the time, and mostly off the record, I imagine. I have two questions, really. Do you deep down believe that the English politicians believe that ultimately, and this goes back to what you were saying about the Italian referendum next month.
Let's get the question.
The Italian referendum next month and the French election.
Yeah, we've done all that. What's the question?
The question is, two questions. Do you think that innately, the British politicians are actually quite comfortable about Brexit and the outcome we're going to get? And secondly, dependent upon the outcome, do you think that David Cameron's decision to have Brexit referendum will maybe accidentally, I have to put that in brackets, vindicated? And secondly...
you've done two questions, sorry. That's enough. I have no idea how to answer that, so I'm doing my Pontius Pilate.
I'll happily... On David Cameron, one of the great ironies of David Cameron is that his historical reputation is now dependent on him being proved wrong. Yes. If Brexit turns out to be a success or perfectly fine, then I think that you'll find in 30 years' time some Peterhouse revisionist historian writing about how, you know, he was the greatest Tory Prime Minister. He saw that you had to have the people have their say, etc., etc., etc. So I think that's the Cameron thing. I think on the deal, I think what you've seen is people coming to terms with what's going on. And that has been combined with, I think, some external events that have strengthened the UK's negotiating hand. But these negotiations are going to be kind of fiendishly complex. Part of the free trade agreement is going to cover services. I think that will be done in a separate agreement. And the agreement that covers services will have to go out to the national and regional parliaments of Europe. You know, we could be in a situation where the clock is ticking and we are waiting for the Wallonian parliament to approve the deal. But I think there is a point here, which is the more that the rest of the world sees of the EU, the more the EU is beginning to realise that there is reputational damage to them from a failure to come to an agreement with the UK. So I think there is certainly more grounds for confidence about the kind of Brexit deal the UK will get today than there was on the 24th of June.
James, you mentioned something very interesting to me that I hadn't known, which is that the British want to split up the negotiation between goods and services because goods, I think you said, are a commission competence, and the Brussels Commission can decide that, but services have to be determined by national and even, depending on the local constitutional arrangements, regional parliaments.
So services are a mixed competence. Trading goods is a purely EU competence. So that could be passed simply by a vote in the Council of Ministers and the Parliament. That is relatively simple to do. It is when it starts to involve services that it gets fiendishly complicated, because that's a mixed competence, so you end up having to go out to national parliaments, and in the case of Belgium, regional parliaments. The view of the UK government is that two deals is sensible, because you get the goods deal done smoothly, there's no risk of that being taken hostage, and a services deal is unlikely to encounter kind of local protectionist sentiment. You know, Wallonia doesn't have a banking sector to protect in the way that it has an agricultural and a basic manufacturing sector to protect.
Interesting. We'll squeeze in another couple of questions, and even though we're already over running. Right, we'll take the gentleman there. We'll try and get you, then we'll have one there. I've gone for three. But quick questions. Yes, keep your hand up. We'll get a mic to you. All right, you go first, then we'll hand it down to you. Yes, sir.
Sorry, I took your lead. I was surprised not to see today that there was no discussion on pensions. That would have been a way of raising capital and for the future, because that was mentioned before as well.
It's an interesting question, and it's always talked about accessing pension funds for infrastructure, James, and it never happens. Brown tried to do it. Darling didn't have enough time. Osborne tried to do it. He wanted 20 billion. He never got more than a billion.
It's quite interesting. One thing that I was quite struck by was this Oxford-Cambridge motorway link road. I mean, if there is a road that is bound to make money but is being built, it's that. It's joining up two of the most productive bits of the UK economy. It's essentially running along the top of the UK's golden triangle. I think the fact that even that is being publicly financed, rather than attempt to do it via tolls or the like, it is very telling.
Yes, because that's how you get the pension money in. Yes, sir, keep your hand up, you've got it, right, and then we'll go up there.
Yeah, a question on the potential range of impacts of Brexit. Assuming the Miller and Secretary of State for Brexit case doesn't get overturned by the Supreme Court and Parliament gets their teeth into something, how broad do you see is the range of possible sort of soft to hard Brexit, and what are the potential economic impact? How broad?
James, what if we're working on the assumption the Supreme Court will uphold the lower court, and that Parliament will have to have some kind of vote? What's going to happen, James?
I think it is very, very difficult to vote against the triggering of Article 50, because if you are voting against that, you are literally voting against the referendum result. So I don't think that's going to happen. I think the bill will pass. I mean, the question is whether it can be amended. And I don't think there's a majority in the House of Commons for a single market amendment. Because a single market amendment would essentially mean you are continuing to accept free movement. And I think that lots of Labour MPs are too fearful, are rightly concerned about what it would do to their position, their own seat, if they went back and said, oh, I know this seat voted 65-35 for Brexit, often largely because people didn't like the loss of sovereignty that free movement entailed, but I've decided that we're going to stay in the single market anyway, even though we'll have no say over the rules. So I don't think that's likely. I mean, the question is, the only amendments that I think will both be in order and can pass will be amendments that look like they are designed to strengthen Parliament's hand over the process. If I was a troublemaking Liberal Democrat peer, the amendment that I would put down would be to require Theresa May to come back with a Brexit deal to Parliament with 120 days left on the Article 50 clock. That means that Parliament wouldn't be in the situation where it would have to either accept the deal or there be no deal, but Parliament would be able to say, well, we don't like this bit of a deal and we don't like that bit of a deal. Please go back and try and renegotiate them. That kind of amendment is the only amendment that I can see passing.
And just an outside chance of a clash with Parliament, particularly the Lords, triggering a general election.
Yeah, I think that Theresa May's team are absolutely genuine that they don't want a general election. I think the one thing that would make them go for a general election is if this bill ended up being amended in ways that seriously restricted Theresa May's negotiating hands. I was talking to a crossbench peer the other day and I said, surely the House of Lords knows its limits. You know, the House of Lords has always had a great instinct for self-preservation. That is why it is still there, despite all the anachronisms that it represents. And this person said, yes, but they've been so upset and discombobulated by the fact that the country voted to leave, they might just do something really stupid. I suspect that calmer heads will end up prevailing, that the Lords will end up... Because the Lords knows that if they wanted to get themselves abolished, trying to overturn a referendum result would be a very good way of doing it. So I don't think they will end up doing that, but I think you can't rule it out because I think some people have been driven almost to distraction by it.
Can I add something here? Oxford Econometrics did a study last week, which I thought was quite interesting, where they gamed all the various scenarios. They thought because of what James is talking about, they could see Parliament trying to say, we're not going to give you permission to do that. But really, it's not Parliament's to mould. They can't really tell her, go back and get all these other guys to agree. Because as Cameron found out, getting them to agree in anything is very, very difficult. It's not Parliament's to tweak. So if that doesn't happen, then we basically leave anyway. Article 50 is, you know, permission to leave. Whether we get another deal or not is negotiable. But if we don't... Anyway, Oxford Econometrics figures of all the likely options, the WTO deal, in other words, the bare minimum, is the most likely at the moment. Now, I'm not saying I agree with it, but the people who are trying to game the various scenarios think... In other words, don't think of it as being something which is very unlikely to happen, because a lot of people think it is the single most likely option. Now, I think she'll probably get a deal, but as James says, if Parliament tries to insert itself into something which isn't really Parliament's to mould, they can either say yes or no. If they say no, then it will be the WTO.
Final question from the balcony.
Number of free trade areas, including, for instance, the Korea one, is the fallback position not that we'll fall back to the terms of this agreement rather than WTO, and that as we, the UK, are signatories to this, and the EU is a signatory, and Korea, it's an area that includes all of us. So how can we fall back to WTO when we're actually all in? We're already in an agreement which we will not leave by leaving the EU.
I'm not sure I understood that, but it is true the European Union has a number of free trade agreements.
We're a signatory to separately.
No, we're not a signatory.
We are a signatory. We're a signatory to this agreement.
The European Union is the real signatory. We don't.
But we're actually a signatory. We're
but
a
only
signatory.
Because we are a
separately.
Normal.
We're separately. The EU is a signatory.
Excuse me. I don't want to lose my voice anymore. Sorry. So shut up and listen. The EU has free trade deals with countries like South Korea. It's got one with Morocco as well, many others. If we leave without an agreement, we would fall back on WTO rules of engagement with the EU, and the same rules would apply to countries like South Korea, because under most favored nation status, you cannot discriminate. And these are all most favored nation status countries. So if we can't say we'll do WTO rules, but we'll offer South Korea something better, if they want it, we'd have to offer the same to Europe.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we've actually signed agreement as the UK to join a free trade area.
I don't think
the title of it is the EU-Korea.
I think you're wrong. It's a deal done by the EU. But we'll leave it there, and no doubt someone will correct us. At some stage. If we had done the deal itself, the government would love that because we'd just continue the deal.
Yeah, the result.
We would just continue. We'd just continue the deal. We wouldn't have to negotiate a new deal. Thrown out of what?
Out of that deal.
Why?
Because we're in a free trade area.
No, you've lost me now. No. Over. I knew it was a mistake going to the balcony. Right, we've come to an end here. I think that this autumn statement has, as was said, is very much a holding statement. It's a holding statement because the world is changing and the British government and the OBR and the Chancellor don't yet know which way it's going. It's changing because of Brexit, it's changing because of Mr. Trump, it's changing because we have a different government and we have a new Chancellor. And I think what we will really begin to see where Mr. Hammond wants to go is when it comes to the spring budget when the picture may well be that little bit clearer. We will be back in spring with another one of these events. They're so popular and successful. We thank Old Mutual Global Investors, OMGE, did I get that right again? OMGE, for OMGE, soft G. I knew it was Japanese. OMGE, for being our sponsors tonight. There's a goodie bag on the way out. Everyone can have one except you. you instead will be sent a copy of the WTO rules. The goodie bag contains a copy of The Spectator, an offer of 12 issues for £12, a free Parker pen. I stole this pen from one of the bags, so make sure you don't get that one. And Richard Buxton from OMGE, his view on the Chancellor's statement, as well as a gift from our partners, his view on that will be much better informed than what you've heard tonight. Please thank our panel before you go. And drinks in the bar.